everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. I have a great show for all of you today. Patricia Wood, known to her friends as Patty, the founder and executive director of Grassroots Environmental Education, will be joining me in just a little bit. But first, before she comes on, I want to share with you some things going on in the news, some ways you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with you. This week, in my newsletter, I wrote about getting phthalates out of consumer products. And phthalates are used in many consumer products, including plastic food and beverage containers, plastic wrap, perfume, nail polish toys. And in personal care products and household products, they also are called very often fragrance. They're just listed under the term fragrance. And they're added to plastics to make them more flexible, but they're also known to be really bad for one's health. They could have a negative effect on your hormones and specifically on the male reproductive system. So it's something that we really want to avoid, and you certainly want your kids to avoid it. And the environmental group has a really great list on how to avoid phthalates in the products you purchase. But you know, our environment is just so filled with toxic chemicals, and I'm sure I'll be talking about that in a little bit when Patty comes on. Glyphosate is also, you know, in our environment, and I wrote about that as well. You know, we've been talking about glyphosate as being responsible for the reduction in bees with the bee claps disorder. It's also responsible for the monarch butterflies, and we need these. We need all of our pollinators if we want to have good food. So it's really essential that we all let our voice be heard, because the people that are set up to protect us aren't doing such a good job. So please sign the petition for, to the Environmental Working Group has a petition, and Friends of the Earth has a petition to get glyphosate out of our food, and to get some of the big box stores like Home Depot and Lowe's to stop selling the pesticide. That would really be a wonderful thing. And we all need to just, you know, become involved in our local politics and become active citizens, because they're not going to make the change unless they hear the cries from the public, and we really need to let our voices be heard. I was really happy to hear that New York City is planning to distribute vending machines throughout the city. They're starting with just a pilot program first, so there's just going to be 10 vending machines, which hardly feels like it will be a drop in a bucket. But they will be distributing anti-overdose drugs into communities that are heavily hit by opioid overdoses. And naloxone, also known as Narcan and other names, if it's administered right away when someone does an overdose, it can actually save their lives. And so they're going to be administering or giving out for free in these vending machines Narcan, as well as free syringes, toiletries, and safe sex kits. So this is really, you know, I think this has been a pilot program that's been in some other cities with some success, and New York is trying it. Since the pandemic, we have seen opioid overdoses on the rise. In this study in 2020, there were 2,062 deaths in New York alone from overdosing, which is an increase of 500 from the year before. And this problem is, you know, not just in New York, it's across the country. Since the pandemic and people have been in lockdown, they've still been managing to get drugs to, you know, fill their time, you know, when they are bored, I guess. So anyway, overdoses are really on the rise, and we really need to address the problem. Obviously, we need to get our insurance companies to pay for rehab. We need to realign the penal system in this country. But in the meantime, this pilot program of distributing Narcan and other equipment that's needed to prevent more drugs and really compromised behavior is a really good thing. So check out that article from the New York Times that I shared with everyone. I want to share with you this week's recipe. I had some guests staying here and they purchased some plantains and left before eating them. And I've actually never cooked with plantains before, an honest comment. So I've never cooked with plantains and they were here and they were going to go bad. So I figured I better cook with them. So I looked over the internet and there were some recipes making curry with plantains, and Indian food is one of my favorite foods to make. So I made a plantain chana curry that I want to share with you. What I did do was I steamed the vegetables I was going to use in the curry first, just one to make it go quicker, but also I just didn't know if the timing in cooking plantains was going to be similar to pumpkin and potatoes. And those were the main other vegetables in this curry. So the ingredients you want is a quarter cup of coconut oil, a tablespoon of minced ginger root, one teaspoon of minced garlic or finely chopped garlic, one onion chopped or sliced thin, one teaspoon of black mustard seeds, 2 teaspoons salt, 2 teaspoons cumin, 1/2 teaspoon of coriander and 1/2 teaspoon of cardamom, 1 teaspoon turmeric, 1/4 teaspoon cayenne, 2 tablespoons tomato paste, 1/2 cup of coconut milk. I used 1/2 of my Long Island cheese pumpkin. I have so many. I grew them this year. And so I am slowly working them into recipes so that I can eat them before they go bad. But they store for a long time. And so this was a medium-sized pumpkin, so I used about 1/2 of it. I'd say about 5 cups of it diced. 3 plantains, the ends removed, peeled, and cut lengthwise, and then cut into 1-inch pieces. 4 potatoes cut into chunks. 1 can of diced fire-roasted tomatoes with chili. I use the ones that I get from Trader Joe's that have some chili in it. If you don't like your food spicy, you can just use regular fire-roasted tomatoes. 1 can of garbanzo beans. 1 cup of water. 2 teaspoons of garam masala, and that's a mixed spice that you can find in Indian markets. You can also find them in a lot of supermarkets. I know Whole Foods carries a garam masala, but it's a real aromatic spice blend that has like cloves in it and allspice, and it's really delicious. And 2 tablespoons of chopped parsley or cilantro. I like cilantro, but if you're a cilantro hater, feel free to substitute parsley. So you're going to start by steaming the pumpkin, the potatoes, and the plantains until they're soft and not mushy. And like I said, I first did them all separately because I didn't know how long they were going to take. But I actually, you could have actually done them all together. If you have a wok with a steam basket, you know, bamboo steam basket, you can kind of put the plantains on one side, the potatoes on one, and the pumpkin on one, and steam them all together and just take them out when they're finished. But anyway, I did them separately. And then once they're just a little soft, you know, tender to the touch, but you don't want them mushy because they're going to cook more in the stew. In a large wok, you're going to heat the oil over medium heat and then add the onions. Stir in the ginger and garlic and cook that for a few minutes. Lower the heat, stirring constantly and frying the onions until they're soft and caramelized. Then you're going to add the plantains, the salt, the cumin, the coriander, the cardamom, turmeric, cayenne pepper, and tomato paste, and cook that for another 5 minutes. Cooking the tomato paste really, you know, helps bring the flavor out in the tomato paste and deepens the flavor a lot. Then you're going to add the chickpeas, the black mustard seeds, the water, and the canned tomatoes, and let that cook down for another 5 minutes. Add the potatoes and the pumpkin and the coconut milk, as well as the garam masala, and mix that well. Cover the wok and let it cook down for another 10 minutes, stirring it constantly, making sure it's not sticking to the bottom. Give it a taste. Adjust the seasonings if you like it more spicy. If you'd like more Indian spice without the heat, you can add more cumin. If you like the heat, you can actually add either some curry powder or some more cayenne pepper. And then you're going to garnish it with fresh cilantro. And that's it. I served it with some saffron rice. I have that recipe on my website as well. And enjoy it. It's really a a great recipe. I, you know, have a new love for plantains. Who would have known? And now it's my pleasure to introduce to you my guest this week, Patricia Wood, known to her friends as Patty, is the founder and executive director of Grassroots Environmental Education, which is an award-winning non-for-profit organization dedicated to educating the public about the relationship between environmental exposure and human health risks. She uses a lot of science-driven arguments for clean air, clean water, and a safe food supply, and for stricter regulations of wireless radiation and chemical toxins. Grassroots serves local and state governments, healthcare providers, school systems, community groups, and other environmental groups and individuals nationwide. Patty is a visiting scholar at Adelphi University, where she lectures on the environment and related health issues in the College of Nursing and Public Health. She is also a columnist for the Blank Slate Media's Earth Matters, author of The Child Safe School and Helping to Heal, and co-producer of the film Our Children at Risk. Miss Wood and her husband Doug are co-producers of the nationally syndicated radio show Green Street. And she was also one of the founders of a great farmers market in Port Washington, one of the few all-organic farmers markets on Long Island. And she also helped get organic gardens going in all of the schools in Port Washington, which is not here on her bio, but I know that, and is a wonderful thing in itself. I mean, every school should have a garden, and she really brought that to Port Washington, where she lives. So, Patty, welcome.
Thank you so much. I loved hearing about that recipe that you discovered for those weird-looking plantains that were left in your house.
That's right. And, they're, you know, plantains are funny. You keep waiting for them to get ripe, and they don't get ripe.
No. They're not bananas.
right. They are not bananas.
They are not bananas.
But when cooked, they really do bring a sweetness to the curry. Yeah. And it was really, really delicious. Yeah. So thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really excited to have you on. I know of your work, of course, for so many years. We've actually collaborated on some things together. And, you know, I was there when we were trying to get the local government to ban nitrogen fertilizers on Long Island, which they did not do. I don't know if they have yet, but that was a disappointing outcome.
That was politics. But
yeah,
go ahead. We're not giving up on that. We're going to bring that back in this session again.
Good, because you know, we all know here on Long Island we depend on our aquifers, our water, for our water, and the nitrogen fertilizers are really seeping down into the aquifers, and it's a bad thing. So we will come back to that. But anyway, going to your website, Grassroots Environmental Education, you have so many topics that you focus on. What are you prioritizing now?
Well, it's tough to prioritize. As you said, yeah, there are so many different issues that are really very urgent, especially because they are impacting, you know, the most vulnerable populations in our society, especially children and pregnant women, and people who have compromised immune systems, and so on and so on. But, you know, I think that when you start an organization like this, you do it because you were born with a justice gene. And I think you have that same gene, Bhavani, yeah, you know, where you feel like you need to do something because this is just not right. It's not right that big corporations and industries are putting out there for consumers to use products that they know can cause serious both short-term and long-term consequences. And there are other industries that are contaminating our water and our air and our food supply, as you have mentioned. It's very, very interesting to see how much glyphosate is in the food supply, especially in those foods that our children eat. And many children are very fussy eaters, right? They just eat certain foods over and over and over. And that's one of our issues, in that children really have very limited diets. And if the foods that they do, you know, like to eat on a regular basis contain these high levels of glyphosate, you know, who knows what the long-term consequences are? We know, right, that glyphosate is linked to non-Hodgkin lymphoma, We also know that it has, you know, has other issues associated with it. There are many researchers that are talking about the autism epidemic and the, you know, being, you know, in lockstep with the amount of glyphosate in our food supply. We know that glyphosate will destroy our good gut bacteria, and the gut and the brain are very, very closely connected. So we just interviewed a researcher on this particular topic from MIT, who has been doing this research for over a decade. And it's very, very compelling information that they're finding. But anyway, so how do we prioritize? Going back to that, it's really hard, except that we do prioritize impacts on children, with the theory that if you get legislation or protective policies or resolutions or whatever it is on whatever level of government to protect children, then by default, you're protecting the entire population, right?
Right. So also most of the standards that we hear of the safe levels are on large men, right?
That's, I mean,
they're,
right.
They're
That's
on
right.
men. They're not even on women.
That's
they're on
correct.
Men. And so when you then transfer to children, it's mm-hmm. a whole different level of safety or not safe.
Absolutely. And it's so obvious why, right? It's just, you know, all you have to do is have eyes and be able to see that a child is much smaller than an adult, right? And so they have a smaller body. So per pound of body weight, they take in whatever is in their environment, be it food or water or chemicals or whatever happens to be in the environment, they're taking in more of that per pound of body weight. So that's one thing. Their bodies are also not developed yet, right? They have undeveloped immune systems, detoxification systems, elimination systems. And so even enzymes that we have that help break things down, toxins in our body and in our liver and so on, they don't have yet. So you're talking about a still developing body, which is vulnerable because they have a lot of growth going on, a lot of cell division going on, which is always vulnerable, right? And so then they also have typical behaviors that adults do not have. They play on the floor. They play on the grass. They have this typical hand-to-mouth behavior. So they're constantly putting their hands in their mouth. We were doing a film about children and their natural behaviors and why it made them more vulnerable. And so we got permission from a second grade teacher to come into the classroom and just film, you know, how children behave, right? We got all the releases from all the parents of the children in that class. And we went in hoping to find at least one child who had their fingers in their mouth, right? Well, every child in that second grade classroom, now this is not infants and toddlers, these are second graders, had their hands in their mouth, in their nose, rubbing their eye, doing, you know, just, it's what human children do to learn about their environment and to become part of that environment. They're touching, they're tasting, they're smelling, and it's all happening on their faces, right? And so they are disproportionately exposed and they are disproportionately affected by things that are in their environment that may be harmful.
Mm-hmm. Especially you mentioned playing on the floor or the grass, especially, you know, when we spray our lawns with pesticides and then the kids are playing on them. I mean, you know, we all have seen the little flags the day that they spray, but it doesn't just go away after they spray. I mean, it's still there and lingering,
right.
And the kids are playing on the grass and, you know, soccer. They spend hours and hours.
I mean, you can, you know, as spring approaches, when we are talking about, you know, mid-March to mid-April into May, you're going to find these little yellow flags that are what I call the harbingers of spring, right? And they're going to be all over people's lawns. People don't really understand how toxic pesticides are and how not only are they toxic to actually touch them or to breathe them in as they're being applied or as they're off-gassing or volatilizing into the air, but they're also becoming part of our water supply. As you mentioned earlier in the show, that we living all of us living here on Long Island are getting our water from underground aquifers. And we have three underground aquifers. We have the Upper Glacial Aquifer, we have the Magothy Aquifer, which is in the middle, and then we have the Lloyd Aquifer, which is the deepest and oldest aquifer on Long Island. When I say old, we're talking about millions of years old. All three of these aquifers were placed underneath Long Island at the end of ice ages. And at the end of an ice age, what happens? The ice melts, right? And so that's where all of this water came from underneath Long Island. The Upper Glacial Aquifer, which is the easiest and cheapest to access for water companies and so on, is really no longer used for our drinking water. Because in even in some places, it's not even used for irrigation because it's so contaminated with human activities, right? I mean, with the chemicals from human activities, whether it's dry cleaners or gas stations or pesticide use. And it's not just on homeowners' lawns, but also, of course, on golf courses, which we have many of on Long Island, right? And we have lots of fields which are being used, municipal fields and so on. And it's crazy that we have this mindset in order to grow grass, we have to put poisons on it. Whereas the absolute opposite is true, which is that we make a healthy soil, right? And a healthy soil delivers to us and has forever, right? For humans, healthy soil will deliver whatever, you know, happens to grow there, whether we actually plant something or whether it's just growing because nature has deposited seeds there. We need healthy soil. And when you put pesticides on your lawn, you are actually destroying all the healthy soil biology that is critical to growing not only grass, but vegetables and trees and shrubs and everything else. And, you know, all the mycorrhizal fungi and the bacteria and all those things that we need just are destroyed. And besides destroying the opportunity for healthy plant growth, we are also seeing those pesticides leach down into our aquifers. So yeah, mm-hmm. Pesticides is a big deal. In fact, that's how we got started. We started by getting Port Washington, which is my hometown, to actually the school district, I should say, of Port Washington, to actually pass a school board policy prohibiting the use of pesticides. And this happened because I was the nutrition chair at my children's elementary school. And I started an organic garden there. And one day I was weeding, waiting for the kids to get out of school at the garden. And the school district, you know, had their employees out there that day with their backpack sprayers. And he was approaching the garden with, you know, with their little wand, you know, ready to spray all around the garden. I said, "Whoa, what are you doing?" And so I was able to find out that, you know, they just routinely use pesticides on all of the school properties. And we were able to get that school board policy passed. And then within several months, you know, I became very active on this issue. Within several months, I was able to get about 17 school districts between Long Island and Westchester and Rockland County to pass similar board policies, went to Albany and said, "Here we have 17 districts. I have 17 letters from 17 superintendents showing that this is not only efficacious and economical, but it's something that we should do." And so eventually we helped write legislation and got passed still the only ban on pesticide use on school properties in the nation. And New York State has this ban. It's K-12 public, private, parochial, including all daycare centers. And so that really was an introduction to, wow, you know, we could actually do something, right?
Right.
We could actually make things happen. We could actually protect our water, protect our kids, and, you know, and make it a law. So it was very intriguing for us to do that. And then just, you know, that was, you know, a long time ago, like 20 years ago. No, it was 2010. Sorry. So it's not quite 20 years ago for sure. But, we just passed a law that we worked very hard on in New York City on Earth Day with a unanimous vote from the New York City Council to ban the use of pesticides in all 3,000 plus New York City parks across the five boroughs. So we're continuing our pesticide work, and we'll always continue pesticide work because it is so important.
It is. And like I said, I have a couple of petitions on my newsletter, which, you know, I send out every week to try to get people to make it easier for people to take some action, because we really need to get more people involved in these issues. Too many people, I feel, you know, sit back and just let others do the work, and we need to all participate to let our legislators know how important it is to all of us. So how do you, I know you prioritize children, but there's still so many different topics. So what are the current issues that you're working on now? What are you focusing on?
So we are working very, very heavily across all of our programs on wireless radiation. And this is known as RF radiation, or radio frequency radiation, or microwave radiation. There are many different names for it. And it comes from our usage of wireless communications. And we need for this to work. We need devices that are used by the consumer, as well as people at, you know, at work and at school and so on. And we also need the infrastructure to provide the frequencies to actually send and receive signals, right? So that we can get on the internet, we can do all kinds of things. I mean, look at us, look what we're doing right now. I'm hardwired at my home, so I can still do what you're doing. I can get on a Zoom call, I can do a radio interview, but I am completely hardwired. We have no wireless connection at all in our home. One of the things that's really troubling about this particular issue is that the industry, the wireless communications industry, has known about the harm from this type of exposure to this type of radiation for many, many years. Way back when the military first started using microwaves, it was actually the U.S. Navy, and we have studies from the 1950s and 60s about the harm, mostly at that point, neurological harm, reproductive harm, that they were showing from the really voluminous number of studies that they conducted at that time. And then today, we're talking thousands of studies showing harm. And we have many, many different types of harm, you know, from cancers to neurological problems, surely reproductive problems, cardiac problems, what we call EHS, or electromagnetic hypersensitivity, or microwave sickness, it is sometimes called, where people are, you know, extremely sensitive to this and really can't function when they are in the presence of a wireless frequency or that wireless radiation. And it goes on and on. And children, pregnant women, we have an entire site just called the Baby Safe Project, which we started after Dr. Hugh Taylor, who is the head of reproductive sciences and OBGYN at Yale Medical School, conducted research with his colleagues showing that the offspring of pregnant mice who were exposed to radiation behaved very differently from the offspring that were unexposed. And that kind of guided us to say, you know what, it's not worth the neurological harm that they were showing. I mean, it could actually show a difference in the wiring of the prefrontal cortex of those exposed offspring. And so we were saying, okay, we can just add that to the short list of things that pregnant women are supposed to be at least cognizant of, right, during their pregnancy. You know, they don't eat tuna fish sandwiches because of the mercury, right? And they avoid harsh cleaning products. They avoid smoking. They avoid alcohol. And all we're asking here is don't put your phone in your pocket, right? Don't use your growing belly with your baby in it as a table for your laptop. And these are very, very simple things to do, but critically important things to do, because it really will interfere with the normal development of that baby's brain. And so, so we have this, if you can go on the site, it's called babysafeproject.org. You can see the number of signatories to a joint statement, which is mostly medical doctors, OBGYNs, pediatricians, especially a lot of neuro, doctors who are very involved in the neurological health of fetuses and newborns. So that's a very, very important project. It has actually been, we have a brochure about it for pregnant women that OBGYNs and midwives can have in their offices and provide to their patients or their clients. And it has been translated into 7 different languages, most recently into Greek, but it has been translated into German and French and Spanish and Dutch and I don't know. I can't remember them all. But but they're, people are taking this. People in the medical field are taking this very seriously.
Yeah.
So that's that's one of the projects. So we're worried about the fetal development. We're also worried about children in schools today. We have a lot of learning that takes place on computers in school classrooms today, and especially during COVID with remote learning, everybody's been on a computer, right? But in a particular setting in a classroom where kids sit around a communal table, you have 6 or 8 kids all sitting around these large tables, and they're all using wireless devices, and there's a router, and it's not like a homeowner's router. It's like it's usually a more powerful router because it has more computers that is servicing, right? And so when you take a reading in the center of that table where you have 6 or 8 children all on wireless devices, that reading is over the FCC limits, and the FCC limits are the least protective limits in the world, the least protective. In fact, they are only based on how close do you have to get to a large transmitter before it burns your skin? We call these thermal standards. They only are looking at thermal standards, not, which is a biological effect, but we are looking at below thermal levels. When you have non-thermal levels, we are still seeing biological harm in some of the things that I just mentioned, neurological cancers, all different kinds of cancers, especially cancers that that we see on the head where people hold their phone directly against their ear. Okay, so you have a higher incidence of gliomas, which are brain tumors, of acoustic neuromas, which are tumors of the acoustic nerve, and parotid gland tumors are really rising in incidence now in this country and all over the world. And a parotid gland is about the size of an egg, and it sits right underneath your ear. It's one of our salivary glands. And because the phones that we use today are much longer and bigger, and they have 7 antennas in them, when you put them against your head, you are actually also covering that whole area where the parotid gland is. In the early days, we had these tiny little flip phones, right? So they were up higher on the head. Now we're also looking at an increase in thyroid tumors. Yale University did a study on thyroid tumors as well, and eye tumors. So those are typical cancers, but we all paid as taxpayers about $30 million to do a quote unquote definitive study to see whether or not cell phones or wireless radiation could cause cancer. And the first results of this 10-year, $30 million study, taxpayer funded, came out in 2018. And showed that there was what we call very positive connection or association. And they actually use the terminology clear evidence of carcinogenicity, clear evidence of carcinogenicity, mostly in the heart and in the brain. the heart actually has, it's interesting, it was only in the schwannoma cells of the heart. And this was repeated in another study that was done in Italy at the Ramazzini Institute, which the United States also funds. And they were just studying not cell phones, but they were studying cell towers, distant cell towers. And they found the same two endpoints, tumor endpoints in the body. They found the heart cells, the schwannoma cells of the heart, and they found the gliomas of the brain. So it's a really, really interesting battle, I have to say, because we have, you know, an industry that is just incredibly powerful industry. And when I say powerful, they make a lot of money. They're in the trillion-dollar industry category, right? The telecom industry. And they're incredibly powerful as far as their influence in not only in Washington, but their influence everywhere. I mean, every local town that wants to put in, you know, 16 5G towers or 5G antennas, what they call small cell antennas, you know, they have to battle with the telecoms because the residents don't want it. The constituents don't want a 5G tower in front of their home, 15 feet from their kid's bedroom, that's going to be on 24/7. Spewing radiation into their home, whether they use it or not. Mm-hmm. And so the local governments are, you know, they don't have their hands tied. They really need to learn about codes that they can actually put into their local code for whether it's telecom facility code or whatever it is, that whatever it's named in your particular town. But you can find that information on Americans for Responsible Technology, and it's Americans for Responsible Tech, TECH.org, or ART, ART, Americans for Responsible Americans for Responsible Tech.org. We have created this site. It's a national site. There's over 150 organizations from almost every state in the nation, and it is a wealth. It provides a wealth of information, and it's all included in what we call our toolbox. And there you can find how to go to your local municipality and help them put in these protective codes so that you don't wind up with 100 small cell 4G, 5G antennas all over your community.
Mm-hmm. And what about the smart meters that they're starting to put onto our houses? I mean, you know, I got something in the mail that they were going to charge me extra if I deny them
pay the money
putting a smart meter in my house, right?
Right, pay it. It's so critical. Smart meters are utility meters, right? And we on Long Island, we have them for our electrical usage, for our gas usage, and for our water usage. So these are our three utility meters that almost everyone has on their home. They may not have a gas meter if you don't have gas connection, but at least you have two. And they just want to go to a smart meter. They want to actually use smart meters for a variety of reasons. So they can eliminate, you know, people going from house to house reading meters. So you can eliminate all those jobs, right? Mm-hmm. And you can actually collect data. A lot of data. Now, why is it so important to collect data? Because it is so valuable. You can sell data, I mean, for an enormous amount of money. So they're collecting a lot of data. When you're home, when you're using your appliances and what you're using at the time, they can actually charge you more. They can say that there is peak time and there's off-peak time. We can charge you more for peak time, right, during a day, and we can charge you less for off-peak time. It turns out that once you have a smart meter on your home, in many cases, your electrical bill or your gas bill actually goes up. It's very, very interesting as to why they're doing this. It also allows them to capture, you know, a lot of other information. And they say it's, you know, it's easier for them when the grid goes down and blah, 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 blah. No, pay the money to keep the smart meters off your home. California is the only state that has an opt out. So that if you have a utility meter and your particular utility wants to roll out smart meters, you can say no. That's it. You can say no. We actually have the ability to do that here on Long Island. If you are using National Grid for your gas service, they will charge you $7.77 a month to keep your analog meter. It is very critical to keep your analog meters as far as your health is concerned. Incredibly important. And even PSEG Long Island will allow you to opt out. They really are pushing people and they're telling them it's more convenient and, you know, that you're going to see savings and blah, blah, blah. No, keep your meter. Incredibly important to keep that analog meter. Because once you have a smart meter on your home, if you are going to experience sensitivities to wireless radiation, you will experience it sometimes first from a smart meter because it has these very high pulses when it's actually transmitting data. And those high pulses can go, you know, several times a minute to several times an hour to several times a day or hundreds of times a day. It just depends on how the utility sets it. And so it's really, really important to keep your analog meters where you are not being exposed to these high pulses of radiation. And like I said, many people experience for the first time their sensitivity to wireless or RFR radiation or RF radiation once they put that smart meter on someone's home.
And is it similar, you know, I hear about so many people like upgrading their homes to be smart homes, you know, to have everything like, you know, what are they, Alexa, turn on the lights or turn on the music. Or, you know, what is that doing? Is that also
Well, it's making
spewing?
a lot of money for the industry. I mean, they make it sound like it's cool and it's just, you know, it's the latest thing to do. And there are people who are techie types who they just want everything. They want everything wireless. They want to be able to, you know, to be, you know, on an airplane on their way to Los Angeles and lock their front door or open their front door or check to see whether they, you know, left the lights on somewhere or whatever. I mean, there's all kinds of things that the tech community can come up with to sell us. And there are those of us who just buy it and don't think about the potential downside or the harm, the health, you know, issues that are associated with it. But you need to make yourself aware of this. There are some really good sites, Environmental Health Trust, which is EHT.org, is a really good one. Americans for Responsible Tech.org, which I just told you about. Baby Safe Project. .org, TechSafeSchools, .org is another one of our projects where we are looking at the legal implications for administrators and for school boards and for school council or the attorneys that that work for the school districts. What is their duty of care? And what, you know, when they know that there is potential harm, why are they not doing something about it? Why are they not hardwiring those schools? It's a big, big issue. Mm-hmm. Right now, all the schools are concerned about is COVID. I mean, we've had 2 years of a huge delay, really, on rolling out the TechSafe Schools program because it's just crazy. You know, masks or no masks. This kid's father just was diagnosed, so this kid goes home, or do you have a policy where the entire class goes home and quarantines for a week? I mean, there's so many things that are going on in schools that's the distraction is too much to be talking about this really as widely as we would like to, but we are set. We are ready to go once we have an opportunity to reach out to school districts across the country, both public and private, and talk to them about what's going on with this new wireless education that they have all embraced without looking at all of the the facets of it.
Yeah. Same with the smart boards, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, everything. Everything.
Right? It's all
clap. Yeah. And then all the kids bring their phones. So you want to add all the 30 phones and the 30 wireless, you know, laptops or tablets that the kids have been given, right? The Chromebooks have been given to the school districts. It's called brand loyalty, right? This is what, you know, the industry is trying to do with that kind of donation. But in the meantime, you know, you also have, you know, smart, like you said, this, you have a smart board, a whiteboard that is running, you know, wirelessly as well. So it's a tough situation. It's a really tough situation because many people just see it as an incredible convenience. They love being in touch with everybody at all times, day and night, with just a touch of a button, right? And you can just scroll through all your Facebook posts and see everything. I mean, it's like people are addicted. Yeah. It's very addictive behavior.
Well, you know, I'm amazed. I know when I asked you for your cell phone number for Beckham, you said you don't use one. You're the only person that I know that actually is not using it. I mean, I know about the dangers, you know, and yet I still have it. I don't put it in my pocket, you know.
And you don't put it up against your head?
And I try not to put it up to my head, but there's sometimes that I do. And I know, you know, everyone thinks you're supposed to hold it, but actually the instructions, if you actually look at the small print in the instructions, it says, do not hold a cell phone right to your head.
Do not hold this device against your body has been the advice from many of the many of the manufacturers of phones, which means not in a pocket, which means not in a bra or a sports top.
Oh, I see that all the time.
Women
running with it in their bra.
Okay, so you see them all the time with that, and doctors are seeing them with breast cancer, with tumors right underneath the antennas that are directly against it. When you put that in your bra, understand that those antennas now are receiving and sending signals through your body. Breast tissue is extremely sensitive to radiation. Different types of tissue in the body are more or less sensitive to radiation. Breast tissue is extremely sensitive to radiation, all types of radiation.
Mm. Unbelievable. Another thing I wanted to touch on before, I know there's so many things that you cover that I am interested in, but another one that is not talked about a lot, and I know you do work with, is fluoride.
Yeah.
You know, people, myself included, always thought, you know, you want to pick toothpaste that has fluoride in it because it's good for tooth decay and cavities. And, you know, and when my kids were little, the doctor wanted to give me fluoride tablets because there wasn't fluoride in my water. And I was like, no, thank you. You know, I didn't take that. But I think that a lot of people do. People really think you're supposed to also be ingesting fluoride in your water and that that's good for you. And I know you have done a lot of work on that. Can you share with my listeners the negative side of fluoride in water?
Sure. Well, for Long Islanders, we are very fortunate that we do not have fluoride in our water supply. We are one of three places in New York State, Long Island, Albany, and Ithaca, that do not fluoridate their water supplies, their public water supplies. But New York City, obviously, is fluoridated. And we need to really rethink using fluoride in our public water supplies, because applying fluoride topically, which is the only real proven benefit for preventing cavities, okay? That's a topical use where that you actually have a dentist, you know, do a fluoride treatment on your, you know, they paint your teeth with fluoride and then they hold it in your mouth for a while and then you rinse it out, right? You're not ingesting it. And they do that for children too. But topical fluoride treatments are beneficial, you know, for sure. But there are many differences between topical applications where they're using a pharmaceutical grade fluoride, which is, you know, sodium monofluorophosphate or sodium fluoride, and the ingestion of a form of fluoride called fluorosilicic acid, which is an industry waste product. Let's talk about that. Public water supplies are using fluorosilicic acid as their source of fluoride. It comes from the phosphate fertilizer industry. Fluorosilicic acid is an industry waste product. which they have to actually pay to dispose of in a toxic or hazardous landfill, right? But if they sell it, if they sell that toxic waste product, which is a crazy law that we have in the United States, and this is across everything, this is not just fluoride, but if they sell this toxic waste product to a public water supply, it's no longer considered a hazardous waste product. Okay? So we are actually, if you are living in an area where you have fluoride in your water, it's actually not a pharmaceutical grade fluoride, and you shouldn't be ingesting it anyway. No peer-reviewed study has ever shown or indicated that humans require fluoride, even for their dental health. And it's actually really well documented that it shows little benefit. All right. Now, over the past 50 years, we have just seen a significant decrease in tooth decay in the general population in all Western countries, regardless of whether or not they fluoridate. That's because they're using topical fluoride. Right? Most toothpaste contains fluoride unless you choose to buy a non-fluoridated toothpaste. So it costs money to buy this toxic waste product to put in your water supply, which is crazy. So all of these municipalities are spending money for a toxic waste product. So the corrosive nature of fluoride, it actually negatively impacts the infrastructure, the water infrastructure. So you have to put in even more money besides purchasing that fluorosilicic acid. You have to incur additional expenses to maintain and replace these prematurely aging pumps and pipes, because the fluoride will actually create a corrosiveness in those pipes. All right. So most of the fluoride added to the water just goes down the drain. And I'm just talking about the cost effectiveness right now, right? Most of it goes down the drain. Over 99% of the water that's used for flushing toilets, taking showers, washing dishes and clothes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You're all using fluoridated water for that, right? Because it's in the public water supply. So you're just wasting what you think is a positive thing for your, for the public. So anyway, so now let's look at the studies. So it has some really negative consequences, and I think most people don't even know this, but the American Dental Association has actually advised parents to reduce the levels of fluoride for children under 6 years of age, and they actually think that children should not have fluoride under 6 years of age, which is so interesting because you have a pediatrician who said, here, I want to give you polyvisol fluor, right? I want to add fluoride to your infant's vitamin formula, but they're actually saying avoid it under the age of six. Crazy, right? And then they are also advising parents to avoid preparing baby formula with fluoridated water. So now this becomes an environmental justice issue. How many people who are living on the edge, right, paycheck to paycheck, and have a baby or two babies who are drinking formula, right? And you have to buy non-fluoridated spring water or distilled water, whatever you're buying to mix your baby, that's just an expense that most people who are living in those underserved communities cannot afford. So it leads to decreased brain function. These are all things that we know of, including lower IQ in children, and it can increase the severity of diabetes. It absolutely contributes to, and actually causes dental fluorosis. 41% of all adolescents from the age of 12 to 15 have dental fluorosis. And it's actually that mottling and discoloration that you see on people's teeth, that it can either be brown or white spots, but that is dental fluorosis. It occurs when the teeth are forming from infancy through 8 years of age. So it also can be indicative of the same kind of modeling that is happening in the skeletal system and in internal organs, but we can't see them. We can just see the evidence of it on the teeth. So a study by the National Cancer Institute was looking at cancer risks from fluoride, and they found an increased incidence of a rare form of bone cancer in boys, not girls, but in boys under the age of 20 who lived in areas with fluoridated water. And then just recently in the JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, they published a study showing that maternal fluoride exposure was positively associated with a lowered IQ score in children. So we're talking about adverse effects on children's intellectual development from fluoridated water. It's crazy.
It is.
It's just, it's just crazy. The story of it is really crazy. And if you want to, you can find all kinds of studies and references about fluoridation of water. I mean, it was, you know, they like to tout it as one of the greatest things of the, you know, of the 20th century, that we fluoridated water and we kept everybody from, you know, from losing their teeth. Not true. Not true. Just an opportunity for the industry to unload a toxic byproduct of their manufacturing process onto public water supplies.
Yeah,
how much fun is that? How much fun is that?
These big industries have figured out all these ways of, you know, selling their toxic waste. I mean, you know, the fracking industry sells their toxic waste to de-ice the streets.
Right, right. And the tire industry sells their waste to put into artificial turf fields. You know, I mean, tires are really hard to get rid of, because they, you know, in their, without being shredded, when they're just tires, landfills don't want them because they just, they wind up being mosquito breeding, you know, areas because of their shape. But we are finding all kinds of chemicals that are extremely dangerous in these artificial turf fields, which are using the ground up rubber tires for a cushioning effect on the field. That is one of our major issues right now too, is artificial turf or synthetic turf.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. There's so much. We're just about out of time. I would like you to share your website with everybody, and you know, I will also share it, you know, in my newsletter so that everybody can find the work that you're doing, because it's really amazing. And I thank you so much on behalf of another Long Islander. You're doing so much for our area and across the country. So thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. It takes a village, right? It takes a village to do all of this work. But our website is grassrootsinfo.org, grassroots with an S on it, grassroots info.org. And on that website, you can go to any one of our other programs, as I had mentioned, the Baby Safe Project, Child Safe School, and so on and so on, are all accessible if you go to grassrootsinfo.org.
Thank you.
You're so
Thank
welcome.
You so much.
And it's so great to see you.
Likewise.
So we're Zooming, right? So I can say I can see you.
We are Zooming.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. And everybody out there who's joined us today, thank you for joining us. Have a great weekend. And I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.